Assalamu alaikum, welcome to another episode of the Kalam Cast podcast. So we all know about the coronavirus and we've been hearing several things about it on the news. Today we've got two GPs and one specialist. I'll let them individually introduce themselves. And we're all here today to talk about this particular epidemic which is affecting us all. So I'll start on my left side.
Dr. Zahid Haider, and I'm a GP in Thornbury.
Hello everyone, Dr. Shiraz Makri. I'm a general practitioner in the northern suburbs.
Hi everyone, my name is Mateen Mohammed. I'm a dermatologist. I work in Malvern East.
So I thank you all for attending, and it's really a special occasion for us all in order to talk about this particular issue, which we're all facing in our own particular ways. The first question I'd like to ask is, it's a very basic question, and I'm sure we have an understanding to some level as to what the answer is. But let's say there is someone who genuinely does not know the answer to this question. How would you answer the question, what is the coronavirus?
It's one of the viruses among the thousands of others, but we got attention of the virus because of the disease that it caused recently and the new version of it, because all the viruses changes over time. And unfortunately, this particular virus has the disease, which is quite unfortunately lethal and very contagious as well.
Yeah. Okay, does this particular virus have a source?
Yeah, unfortunately, there are theories about it, but it's not confirmed where it come from, but sound like an animal source in China, in Wuhan province. That's what most of the people are saying, but it's one of the theory among others. Yeah. Mm.
The next question I have with regards to this is, can humans become infected with a coronavirus from an animal source?
Yeah, I think initially that's what happened. And then the transmission is from human to human by droplets, like sneezing, coughing.
As far as the evidence is showing so far, though, the transmission appears to be from human to human. People haven't been advised to stay away from pets and so forth.
Yeah.
So the main transmission concern appears to be from human to human.
Right. Yeah. Dr. Mateen, do you have a particular perspective?
Yeah, look,
this?
I think what's been said is I agree with coronaviruses. Are a well-known group of viruses known for a very long time. They cause common colds and amongst other illnesses in both humans and animals. And this particular virus just happens to have changed itself to be able to affect humans now. And now it's acquired this ability to spread rapidly amongst humans. Also cause serious illness in a few people. So that's the reason why it's grabbing all the attention and causing worldwide concern for all of us.
Right. There seem to be some confusion even as to what are the symptoms of this particular virus. Is that something which can be clarified?
Okay, it is difficult and there is a lot of confusion amongst the community of how do you differentiate between a flu virus, a common cold, I've got a runny nose, does that mean I have coronavirus or COVID-19 specifically? That's the mutation or strain of the coronavirus. So just to be very clear, coronavirus is the family of viruses and COVID-19 is this particular mutation which is causing us this headache and pandemic that we're worried about so far. The common symptoms that appear to be prevalent with COVID-19 is a dry cough and a fever. So a dry cough and a fever appear to be the standout symptoms, but that doesn't mean you can't have other symptoms that people have with the common cold, such as a sore throat. That's another common symptom. Generally feeling unwell, achy. You can have a runny nose, but that's also not as common. But the standout symptoms so far seem to be the sore throat, the cough, and the fever.
Yeah, look, I completely agree with that. The other point I'd like to make is the COVID-19 illness and the flu, the regular flu, share a number of similarities in the way they present. So both of them seem to have fever, muscle aches and pains are more common with the flu, slightly more common with the flu than with COVID-19, but the dry cough and fever seem to be the sort of cardinal symptoms of COVID-19. Almost 90% of people have the dry cough and fever. Whereas runny noses, stuffy noses, and sore throats without a fever are more a symptom of the common cold. So if you want to distinguish between these three things, if you have a lot of muscle aches, it seems to suggest that the flu is more likely. If you just have a runny nose, no fever, stuffy nose, then it seems to suggest a cold is more likely. But these symptoms overlap. And even diarrhea can be a symptom of COVID-19 in about 10% of patients. So I think the message is that these things can look similar, but there are some ways of distinguishing between them. But ultimately, testing will probably be required.
I'll also add to that, actually, I think we have to be very careful about making the decision ourselves without medical advice. You know, do I have a common cold? Is this COVID-19? That's where it gets a little bit tricky and you need to seek the medical advice.
May I ask, why is it interchangeably referred to as COVID-19?
It's referred to as COVID-19 as an abbreviation. So coronavirus disease detected in December 2019. And so scientists, I guess, have come up with a name that is easily recognisable and differentiated from the other coronaviruses like the MERS virus and the SARS virus, and hence the name COVID-19 or coronavirus disease 19.
So you mentioned the SARS virus. Why is this virus so different compared to the SARS virus? I mean, we've dealt with the SARS virus in the past. You know, why is this something which is making GPs or doctors somewhat more alarmed?
I think the point there is its infectiousness. Mm. Now, there is a concept called R-naught, which is how many patients with the disease are infected by a single case. So with SARS, there were only about, 8,000 cases worldwide before it died down. So people with SARS were not as contagious, and MERS, there were only about 150 cases mainly in Saudi Arabia. So these viruses were not as contagious, whereas the R-naught, or the infectiousness of COVID-19, is thought to be that one person can infect another somewhere between 2 and 4. Early estimates seem to suggest it was 2.5, but now they're thinking it might be even 4. So that's what's leading to this virus not being confined to one area of the world, but actually managing to spread throughout the world and infect so many, hundreds of thousands, and we fear many more people will be affected by this. So that's the main difference. In fact, SARS and MERS were actually more lethal, but they are not as catching as this particular COVID-19 virus. They're all from the same family of viruses, but that infectiousness is what's giving this virus its added deadliness.
Okay. And the mortality rate with COVID-19 is between 1% and 2%, while SARS was around 60%. So 60% of people who got it, they died eventually.
No, SARS was actually about 8%, and MERS was around about 50%.
Yeah. So we've briefly spoken about the contagiousness of this disease. How may this contagious aspect of this disease make one think twice about, for example, going to the masjid? This is relevant to members of our community, for example.
Yeah, so it's the social distancing thing. That's what public health is saying about. So you have to keep a distance of 1.5 meters. So any droplets coming from the other person's mouth or nose, so that you don't get it. And that's what you have to keep away from gatherings and places where there are a lot of people. And the restriction is nowadays is 100 people inside or 500 outside, but that will soon come to much lesser number because of the infectiousness of the disease.
Adding to that also, alhamdulillah, our Muslim community is so diverse of different age groups. I mean, we have young and old, people of all different ethnicities and backgrounds that attend our masjids. And especially our Jummah prayers, alhamdulillah, we're double parked and we're crammed in these tight confined spaces, sharing the same carpet, sharing the same wudu areas. Some people may have come back from Umrah in the last couple of weeks, I don't know. So all of those factors are going to increase the risk of transmitting this virus to each other. There might be a misconception that, oh, I'm young and healthy, I haven't recently travelled, I don't have a cold, what's the harm, I'll just go to the masjid, I'll take my prayer mat and I won't shake people's hand. And I'll maintain the distance and nothing will happen. But that's besides the point. You could catch the virus and have very mild symptoms or no symptoms, particularly younger children, take it home and transmit it to your parents. And the mortality or the death rate is quite high, even above the age of 60. That's the basic premise that has made me concerned. You are harming the community, not just the Muslims, but non-Muslims. for the non-Muslims and also the elders in society.
Mm. Yeah, and to add to that, I think in general we should be trying to reduce the mixing of people, not just masjid, but also in general cinemas, restaurants. Any non-essential activity should be curtailed, and people should only go out for essential purposes like supermarkets, medical appointments, perhaps pharmacies, that sort of thing. So we should try and reduce the number of people mixing in general to avoid spreading this disease. Mm.
So how easy is it for someone to catch this disease? Is it just as simple as shaking someone's hand and that's it?
The main risk factors that I can see is the proximity, how close people are and interacting, being in a confined small space and the time. So the more crowded or congregated an area is, the more likely that the virus will transmit. So yes, physical contact, like shaking hands, will transmit the small droplets containing the virus, because if you've got the infection, you'll be shedding the virus. And so if you touch your face, if you touch your nose, you'll have the virus in your hands or the droplets, which you can't see with the human eye. And so shaking hands, hugging, touching common carpet or common areas, all those factors can transmit the virus.
Yeah, and adding to that, I think one has to understand that when we cough, the particles which come out, they can coat surfaces, and the virus can live on these surfaces for quite a number of days if they're not cleaned. And so these surfaces can be touched by others, and when we touch those surfaces and then touch our face, especially the eyes, nose and mouth, the virus gets in that way. So the most important thing is to wash hands with soap and water. And there are a number of guidelines, 20 seconds of washing the hands with soap and water. And I think it's really important we try and make sure that hand washing and hand sanitizing is carried out by everybody.
I'm also curious about your own personal experiences. Are you getting a greater influx of patients at the present moment?
Yes, there has been an increase. And from my experience in my GP clinic, there was actually a drop in the patients that we were seeing in January, February, as people were coming back from holidays. Things were a little bit quieter. But suddenly the appointment books are filled, people are freaking out, the reception staff are inundated with phone calls, asking whether it's safe for them to come to the clinic because they've got a cough or a runny nose. So the community knowledge, the community fear has definitely increased. It's palpable, and you can see that. You can see it in the appointment lists that are completely booked out and the phone calls that are coming through. So yes, it's getting busy, and I feel physically tired today. I had a day off yesterday, but I'm mentally and physically exhausted. Every other conversation with every other patient is about the coronavirus. And every patient that we bring into our room before they come in, we have to screen and ask them, do you have a cough, do you have a fever? It's getting busier.
Yes, I can imagine you must be really busy. With the exception of Dr. Zahed, I think everyone knows that my father is also a doctor. I always remember him being very happy during flu season. You know, he's always in a good mood during flu season. So, you know, I imagine, you know, you must be extremely busy. Like, you must be going through extraordinary hours compared to what you did before this epidemic broke out.
What worries me is that we're not even in the depths of the pandemic yet, because the numbers are increasing exponentially. So roughly mathematically, I think that the numbers are doubling about every 3 days. So today, the numbers that I saw before coming in here were in the 700s, or close to
780.
Right. And 4 days ago it was in the 400s.
400s, yes.
So we're not even in the depths of this virus, and I think people haven't started to comprehend that soon enough. And this is the concern: if we don't contain this, the GP clinics are going to be inundated, and we won't be able to cope because we don't have the equipment, we don't have the resources, we don't have the masks to deal with this. Because for every patient that's suspected of COVID-19, we have to wear the correct PPE, the personal protective equipment, and that's not simple. That involves not just a face mask, but gloves, goggles, an entire gown that goes over the clothing, and there aren't enough supplies. And same thing with emergency departments and hospitals and ICUs. They're going to be absolutely inundated. We're not even there yet. This is just the beginning.
That raises an interesting question, and that is, when we are in the depths of the virus, how will things change? Will it change even more than it is now?
You only need to look at the countries that are ahead of us in the exponential curve. Just look at what's happening in Italy, in Spain, and see what they've done. They were relaxed about the rules in the beginning, and they didn't contain it. And now they're absolutely inundated. They've got medical students that have been promoted to the level of a doctor to try and deal with the demand. They're having to turn away older people because they don't have enough ventilators. So I think you just need to see the countries that are ahead of us to get some idea of how bad this can get.
The numbers are truly frightening. Hopefully, with all the measures that are being put in place, I pray that there will be a slight flattening of the curve, perhaps, but the numbers truly are beginning to alarm a lot of medical professionals.
That raises a concern in the sense that winter is very close. How is that going to increase the likelihood of this disease spreading itself out?
Well, it's not just this disease. I think the flu season, you know, influenza is also coming. And I think the best thing people can do is try and get their flu vaccines early. And perhaps some people might get the pneumococcal vaccine as well if they're eligible for that. But I let the other doctors spill you on that.
Yeah, absolutely. But just adding to that, the issue with the winter season is that it gets really busy anyway in any given year, if not a pandemic year, but any given year. People get a lot of coughs and colds, and we had a big flu season last year and the year before. So it's going to get harder to differentiate who has the coronavirus and who doesn't have COVID-19, sorry, and who has actual flu or common cold. It's going to be hard to differentiate. And if we set out to swab everybody, we're going to run out of swabs. So we've got a bit of a dilemma there. Mm. Yeah.
So during this time as Muslim doctors, are there any particular reflections that you've had during this time? Because it is quite amazing in one sense, you know, something so tiny, a virus, has had this huge effect on the way we live and the way we're thinking and that we're perceiving the world around us and so forth. So are there any personal reflections that you can share about this?
Yes, something that a lot of people have been laughing about and making memes on the internet, obviously, is the buying frenzy, the panic buying. The shelves are just empty with bread loaves and milk and of course the coveted toilet paper, which we all know of. But I think besides the jokes, I think that just really highlights how worried everybody is about their own mortality and the mortality of their loved ones. I think it's human nature that we really fear death, and so we can sometimes go to irrational, illogical lengths to deal with this fear. And I think people are just dealing with this fear in the way that they see best fit, and so panic buying is one form of that. But just that fear of mortality, whether you're a religious person or not a religious person, that was the first thought that came to my mind.
Look, I would say to add to that, I still think there's cause for optimism, and I feel that although they say that vaccine is 18 to 20, 12 to 18 months away, it might be a little bit sooner. And there's probably some medications as well, which are possibly going to help people who are very sick with COVID-19. And hopefully those sorts of things might come and be able to help some of the really sick people. The vaccine will obviously prevent the spread. So I think this is certainly a time in our lives which no one is going to forget in a very long time. But at the same time, some hope for optimism and perhaps turnaround in about 6 months is what I'm hoping for.
So apart from an actual vaccine, are there any preventive measures such as a good diet, exercise, anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, these are general measures. It's not that it's going to cure your coronavirus overnight if you start exercising and eating healthily. So we have to differentiate the myths from the facts. There are a lot of WhatsApp messages going around that my mom and dad's generation seem to be sharing. There was one about eating garlic and that will cure your coronavirus, or if you drink a hot drink, that's going to cure the COVID-19. So we have to be a little bit careful. But of course, maintaining a healthy, active lifestyle is going to strengthen your immune system, and no doubt you'll be able to fight infection, not just COVID-19, but any disease process you'll be able to fight better if your body's in a general healthy state. So yes, definitely eating healthily, regular exercise, watching what you put into your body, all of these things are really important just on a general note, and that's applicable even now, even with the COVID-19 pandemic. So you can still go outside and jog. you don't have to do that in a crowded environment, for example.
And to add to that, I'd say smoking cessation. You know, if people can give up smoking, would be a huge help in reducing the effects of this virus and a whole host of other medical problems. You know, so I think I'd encourage anyone who smokes to think twice about giving that up. It's a really good opportunity to put in place. It's got an immediate payoff. You know, quitting smoking.
It's a good excuse to give up smoking, I guess. Now, here, I've got another question. Depending on how you answer, it's probably either going to get you in trouble or me in trouble, right? And that is, look, my parents are overseas at the moment, and they're coming back very soon, in a day or two. What should I be doing? How much of a distance should I be keeping?
So, first of all, I hope your parents are watching the Australian news while they're overseas, wherever they may be, and I wish them the best of luck. I hope they keep safe in their travels. But obviously just making sure that they're aware of the rule, of the 14-day rule, that they need to isolate and really stay away from the public and even their loved ones. So that includes you, Sheikh Furqan. You can't go and receive them at the airport and give them a hug, unfortunately, and especially not your kids. So they need to maintain isolation, and maybe you can buy them some toilet paper and keep their kitchen pantry a little bit.
Okay, so we dodged a bullet with that one, inshallah. And next question, are face masks really helpful? I see a lot of people walking down the street. Some of them are very stylish, mashallah, but are they really helpful at the end of the day?
My opinion is that for the general public, if everybody was to just put on a face mask and start walking outside, whether you have symptoms or not, Australia will run out of face masks, and we've got 25 million people. The doctors and health professionals and the sick people need the face masks, so that's a little bit impractical. But of course, if you've got symptoms and if you are concerned, then before entering a place that's crowded, if you're going to come in contact with people, or before going to hospital or medical facility, then yes, wearing a face mask will be helpful. But by default, it doesn't mean that everybody needs to start wearing a face mask and go outside. I think it's just not practical, but that's just my view.
Do they really help, though? Do they have that effect of... I've heard the opposite, that they don't really...
Oh, I wouldn't go so far as to say that they do nothing. There are different grades of face masks. What the health professionals need to use is the N95 face mask, and I forgot the other name for it. But that basically, you need a good seal over the face and the nose. So the common, cheaper surgical masks that don't provide the good seal won't provide as much protection, but there could be some benefit from it. So I wouldn't say that they're useless.
But if they don't have any symptoms, they doesn't need a mask. If they're not coughing and sneezing and they keep the distance, that's what the rules are.
I suppose the idea is to keep unwanted elements outside rather than...
Yeah, but if they keep that 1.5 meter distance, that's okay.
The point is, the face masks are good for those who have symptoms, but for those who are well, they don't protect them as much. So if you've got a cough, if you're self-isolating... it's definitely recommended that you wear face masks, even if you're at home self-isolating, so that you don't cough and coat the surfaces with the virus. And if you have a cough and you're going to visit one of your general practitioners, you want to wear a mask so that you don't spread the virus on your way there. But for the general public, I don't think it's necessary. It doesn't help. And the other danger about face masks is that sometimes... if people touch the outside of the face mask and there's virus on the outside and they don't wash their hands and then they happen to touch their face, eyes, nose, they can actually contaminate. And some of the studies for MERS and SARS shows that people who wore face masks actually had a higher rate of picking it up. So face masks need an instruction manual on how to be used. And most people who think, you just put it on, they might not use it properly. So I think... it's really, really important to understand that face masks should be used in a certain way, disposed of in a certain way, and we shouldn't touch the outside of the face mask without washing our hands first before we do anything, you know. So they have dangers as well, to add to all the other points about running out of face masks, you know. So that's the biggest concern.
Yeah. I'm noticing that some of these manufacturers are having a field day. You know, on the social media, you'll see advertisements for the face masks, and even for toilet paper as well.
I think the government is clamping down on that, actually. They're trying to end all those eBay auctions and Amazon websites which are selling things at grossly inflated prices. So I think the value of buying face masks, I mean, hand sanitizer is also being sold for a huge premium. But hand sanitizer, if you can't get it, I think washing your hands with soap and water is actually more effective than hand sanitizer. If you had the choice between washing your hands with soap and water and using hand sanitizer, it's actually better to wash with soap and water. And there's certainly no shortage of soap and water. So I think people need to realize that buying hand sanitizer is not their top priority, which is going to save them, you know. So I think that would be a really important message to convey as well.
Let's say there is a hypothetical situation where someone we know, maybe a family member, does come in contact with COVID-19. What then?
So there is a criteria and they have to be isolated. There is a testing centers all over Victoria in all the major hospitals. They can go there and have been tested for COVID-19. The results usually take 2 to 3 days and they have to be in isolation for those days before they know their results. The treatment is symptomatic. You can have paracetamol, keep yourself hydrated. And if you are really unwell, then you have to get to a hospital to be admitted. But that's in a very rare situation.
I'll also add to that, though, that the criteria keeps getting updated for who will get tested. So just because you've come into contact with a confirmed case, at least from the criteria until date, you won't automatically get tested. So by the time this podcast gets released, some things I'm saying are going to be outdated, maybe. But so, for example, at the moment, if you have symptoms in addition to having come in contact with the confirmed case, or in addition to having travelled in the last 14 days before you got the symptoms, then you'll get tested. We're not in a position to test everyone who thinks they've come in contact with the suspect case or every single person who has cold-like symptoms. There is a criteria, and you'll have to go through that either through the hotline, the COVID-19 hotline, or a health professional.
Yeah, and to add to that, what I'd say is so if you come in contact with someone, it's not that you will definitely get it, right? So we don't know whether you'll get it or not. So I think the most prudent thing to do would be to sort of self-isolate for 14 days is what they recommend. And if those 14 days pass without any occurrence of symptoms, then you probably didn't get it. Now, testing kits are in short supply. Testing swabs are in short supply. Reagents are in short supply. So not everyone is going to get tested. So the best thing that people can do is to isolate themselves. Now, if you do get sick, again, it's important to point out that it doesn't mean you're going to have a serious outcome. It's important to know that 80% of people who get COVID-19, confirm COVID-19, will have a mild illness, which will pass off like a mild flu. They might have a few body aches, but after 7 days or so, they'll start to feel better. Right? The other 20% may have more serious illness, and out of those 20%, 5% might end up in ICU. And the other 15% just need hospital support with oxygen and those sorts of things. So I think there's still a really good chance, 4 out of 5 chance, that if you catch COVID-19, you'll be fine. And that especially is true for the younger people, right? So if you are under the age of 40 or younger, then your chances of getting anything serious, dying from this, is probably less than 1 in 200, you know? Probably even less than that. So I think people shouldn't panic, especially the younger people. Older people, especially those who have diabetes, blood pressure, heart disease, smokers, those people might need more care. And they might also need to be aware that the worsening which occurs with COVID-19 can occur after day 7, day 8. When they think that they're going to get better, they can suddenly go downhill. So that's another thing to point out. So it seems like it's very hard to distinguish between people who are going to get better and then people who are going to go downhill. So after day 6, day 7, either you get better or you could go downhill. So that's a critical time as well.
Now, coming back to our community, we're recording this on a Friday, and there are some mosques that have continued to hold Friday prayers, regardless of the fact, for example, that the Australian Fatwa Council has made a ruling regarding this issue. Do you think it's okay to continue going to Friday prayers just as usual?
I think it comes back to a consistency in the message. The message needs to be consistent and clear. And so GPs across Australia, leaving the religion aside, were initially a little bit confused because the messaging from the chief medical officers and our government leaders was confusing. I think that can also be translated into our community. If the message is not clear and consistent, if we've got some imams releasing a fatwa saying it's unsafe to go to the masjid, then we all have a responsibility. So therefore, pray Zuhr in your offices and homes. And then you're going to have two masjids or three masjids who are going to go the other way and hold a Jummah. I just cannot comprehend how that makes sense. I can't give religious advice, but just from a pure scientific data point of view, you don't even need to be a doctor, you don't need to be an epidemiologist. You just need to understand basic year 10 maths to understand the numbers. The numbers are doubling every 3 to 4 days. And so this is about protecting the wider community. So by attending this Jummah of 499 people, even if it's not illegal, what is the reasoning behind it? What if one person catches an infection? Like our fellow colleague has pointed out, the R value is 2.5 people or something. So one person, if one person transmits an infection to three other people, then those three people are going to transmit it to another three people. So that's 9 people. It's just simple data. There are graphs and you can go into all the science and medical science behind it, but you don't even need that to understand how risky the situation is. And the countries that are already in the depths of this pandemic, such as Italy and Spain, they're really struggling. So it's beyond my comprehension as a person who's not a student of knowledge, who doesn't have an in-depth knowledge of Islam. I cannot believe that our Muslim leaders can give such a mixed message. And it's beyond my comprehension that two or three masajid can go the other way and follow their own rules. Regardless of the medical advice from specialists, doctors, epidemiologists, regardless of the fact that the holiest of mosques in the world, like Masjid al-Nabawi, have been closed. I'm not sure if Masjid al-Nabawi had Jummah today, but the access is restricted. So how can a small mosque in Melbourne go the other way, and what point are they trying to prove? That is my question.
I'd like to make two further points. One is that in Malaysia, there was a big upsurge after an Islamic conference. So people mixing, it doesn't matter whether they're Muslim or non-Muslim, if people mix, you can spread this. And that's the last thing we want. And we know what's going to happen if it spreads and it gets out of hand. The second point I'd like to make is that some people are called super spreaders. They can not just infect 3 people, but they can infect literally hundreds of people. There was one case in South Korea in which one woman managed to infect more than 1,000 people. She was called case number 31. Now, it only takes one person who might have a higher viral shedding. It's not that they are trying to deliberately do this, but they might have some sort of abnormality that they're shedding the virus so profusely that they can spread it so vastly. And it takes just one person to, I guess, if that person wasn't there in South Korea, their numbers would have looked like Singapore, which is flattening out now. So it just goes to show that we can't take the risk. We just can't take this sort of a risk for this disease. Mm.
The other issue it highlighted for me was the ignorance and lack of knowledge in our community amongst the general public and the leaders to make such a decision. The only way I can make sense of this is that you have to be really lacking the knowledge, the sheer knowledge. I cannot believe that people can be so ignorant and blindsided and make such a decision that could impact the entire community.
Dr. Zahir, do you have any opinion regarding the matter?
Yeah, what I think is the gathering of that many people, even if they were 1 meter or 1.5 meter apart, they will still be walking, talking to each other, going to the car park, parking for that many people, it will still spread the disease, and that's what it's all about. COVID-19 is the it's the infectiousness of this disease.
Yeah, I think
and
it's
that's
also
what's the problem.
Perhaps important to also note that if you're not going to the masjid to pray, it doesn't necessarily mean that you should, you know, go to the other doctor was saying, to the cinema, for example, or to the mall or something of the like. So you can spread it there.
Exactly, it's the gathering. Any gathering will do the same, and that's why it's we should avoid gatherings.
And the point is not the number. I mean, the state, the government has made a rule of limiting 500 people getting together. I mean, that's an arbitrary number. The spirit of the law or the idea behind it is basically lots of people getting together. So even if you have 498.5 people out of 500 attending, yes, you haven't broken the law, but what have you achieved? I don't understand. Yeah.
I think we should discourage people from mixing. At this time, I think the less people mix, the better.
From a more somber perspective, we've seen, you know, people who are coming from a Muslim background passing away as a result of the disease, you know, particularly older people and so forth. Now, let's say that this does happen locally. And from what I am understanding from what you've said so far, it's inevitable to some degree. Is there any risk for anyone attending the funeral prayer for someone who has passed away from COVID-19?
It's an important question. It's a depressing question. And London is dealing with this, and some countries overseas are dealing with this. I tried to find the answer, actually, there is a Lancet study that was recently published showing that people that have passed away are still shedding the virus.
Yeah, that's true.
It's really sad. So people that have passed away are still shedding the virus. So it's actually it's going to be a public health risk, or even for the family members to handle the body and touch without gloves and things like that. So that's one thing. I'm not sure what the Department of Health guidelines are in Australia or if they have released guidelines. I tried to look this up on the internet recently, but I know that the Centre of Disease Control has issued some restrictions on this, so it's a watch this space sort of situation. But I think there is a potential that there will be restrictions in the way the funeral rites are conducted. I mean, the traditional ghusl of the body and the shrouding and janazah prayers with hundreds of people getting together and then going to the gravesite, I think all of these things are going to be restricted. And even if we're allowed to conduct the ghusl, I can't imagine that there wouldn't be some guidelines around this, such as wearing the gloves, the face masks, the clothing protection. So this is another, a whole other kettle of fish we're dealing with, and really depressing, especially for the loved ones. I mean, imagine a family member passing away and you can't even touch their body or hug them or be there for their janazah, or if you're infected yourself, you couldn't even attend their janazah. How depressing would that be? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, it's a really sad sort of situation. As I was saying, you know, some people get better after day 7, and the people who don't get better, they get worse and they continue to shed the virus at an alarming rate. And even when they die, they continue to shed the virus till that point and perhaps afterwards, all right? So they are infectious, unfortunately, and we have to take all sorts of precautions to minimize that spread. So special situation, very sad situation, but we have to put in place those measures.
And it's a conversation that we have to have now. I think we can't just ignore it because it's a somber topic. I think the masjids and the facilities that have the janazah facilities, they need to be ready for this. And
the undertakers need to start. Yeah, the undertakers need to have PPEs as well, personal protective equipment. So, you know, I mean, I'm not sure whether they have that level, like the N95 masks and the face visors and those sorts of things. And, you know, I mean, they might be at risk as well.
The general advice which people are receiving is to stay home, using this term social isolation, which we're hearing more of in recent days. What kind of advice would you give to someone who requires social isolation or has been recommended to do so?
So if you're a confirmed case or if you have symptoms, then you need to quarantine yourself. So obviously, if you live in a shared home with your parents or other family members, it's going to be a bit hard to just go in and camp in the backyard, especially with the winter months coming ahead. But you'll need to do your best, really. Try to keep to your bedroom, use a different bathroom, and really emphasize the need for hand hygiene, really washing your hands and taking all the necessary precautions. But it's going to be all the quarantine stuff and the hand hygiene stuff that's been talked about. So it means not going outside and really just staying within the boundaries as best as you can.
Right. There seem to be a lot of stigmas associated with this particular virus. Would you agree with this?
Yeah, because it's still new, COVID-19. So we're in 2020, but this was only detected in December last year. So I think the stigma may be because it's new. It's a new virus that's mutated. But it doesn't mean that if you've been infected with COVID-19 that you should be banished and shut off from society forever. There is a light at the end of the tunnel. You know, for most of us, as my colleague pointed out, you're going to get over it, like you get over a cold or a flu, particularly if you're young and healthy. You need to quarantine yourself for 14 days and be cleared. And once your symptoms are cleared, then you can continue. I don't see why society needs to have a stigma against such a person. Mm. It's really no different from having a flu or a cold once you've recovered.
And the good thing is, if you've recovered, you probably have immunity against COVID-19. We don't know that for sure, but it would seem likely that you'd be immune. And so you might actually be a valuable member of society. You might be able to participate in things which other non-immune people can't participate. For example, if you're a teacher or if you're a healthcare professional, you might be more valuable having had recovered from COVID-19. So
it's like the measles, basically.
Yeah, look, we can't be sure. It's a new disease, so we don't know if immunity is long-lasting. We don't know that for sure. But we'd imagine that if you have recovered, then immunity would be at least there for several months, and perhaps you'd be able to not get reinfected, and you might be able to help out in situations where other people can't. You know, so
mm. It's interesting to note how information regarding this virus has basically gone viral. Right, that's the irony.
no pun there.
Right? It's interesting that people from many different backgrounds and professions, and they're all having their own kind of perspective or take regarding this virus. And that's troubling to one degree. That's helpful in one perspective as well, because you're spreading information, spreading knowledge. And sometimes when you spread knowledge, sometimes the wrong things go out. And for us, I think as Muslims, this should be troubling, because in the Quran it's written, فَاسْأَلُوا أَهْلُ الذِّكْرِ إِن كُنْتُمْ لَا تَعْلَمُونَ. Ask the people of knowledge if you do not know. So do you have a particular take on this, or what would you say regarding this? Any comment?
I mentioned the WhatsApp messaging earlier. I think it's going to be really hard to not have this inundation of information, particularly in this age of social media. So most young people don't even watch the news on television or read a newspaper. They get their news from Facebook and WhatsApp. So I would say be careful if you receive a forward or a text, particularly for our parents' generation. They're getting videos, you know, saying that you need to use a blow hair dryer to your face to kill the virus and things like that. So just be careful before you forward the text. It's really easy to press a button and forward.
You seem to be very critical of our parents' generation.
No, I think it's just increasing the anxiety when you have misinformation. We're already inundated. So the other thing would be to just go back to the sources. So if you're a little bit unsure of where this information is coming from, then go back to the health.gov.au or Department of Health website. Or if you're concerned about your symptoms, call the hotline. Or if your symptoms are more severe, in that case, you may have to present to a fever clinic in one of the major hospitals. But if you're unsure, try to go to the reliable resources that the government has set. Mm. And think about where the information is coming from, because that video could have been WhatsApp through lots of different channels, and God knows what the evidence is behind it.
All right. As we wrap up, what is one final thing that you'd like to leave our listeners or our audience with?
I think what I'd say is that we should still be optimistic. I don't think a vaccine is too far, and I think some medications to perhaps help some of the more sicker people is not far away. There are already trials of medications going on, and vaccines, you would have heard in the news that there's already a candidate vaccine which is being trialed on humans. So I think I'm optimistic that in 6 to 8 months time this will be behind us, and hopefully this will pass, and most of us will be okay with this. So that's the message I'd like to convey.
So we can do a follow-up episode on 6 months' time, basically. So, Dr. Zahir, any final words or any words of advice you'd like to leave the listeners with?
Yeah, one thing, precautions. Precautions are most important. Yeah, just wash your hands, keep away from public places. And if you are unwell or you've overseas travel or come in contact with, so ask medical advice.
Dr. Shiraz?
I think my main message would be, no matter who you are or what your age is, just take responsibility. We live in this society. It's a shared responsibility, and And I think this is an opportunity for us to actually unite together, not in a physical sense, but we can actually collectively take a lot of responsibility, try to spread awareness, and really just look out for each other, think about your actions, think about how you can protect the community. And so this is an opportunity for us to take some responsibility, and we've got a great healthcare system. And if we can contain this virus, and it's going to take everybody's effort, it's not just one person, it's a collective effort, then I think we can really get behind this and become united. And I think drawing on the Juma example, it emphasizes how much unity we really need, whether there's a pandemic or no pandemic.
Mm. How can faith play into this issue that we're facing, by the way?
Yeah, really important. I think, alhamdulillah, we're really fortunate that we have such a solid foundation and a strong faith. And a lot of our Muslim leaders, I feel like I've just been so negative in this podcast, but a lot of our Muslim leaders have been so positive in renewing and helping us renew our faith, in having hope. We believe in the power of prayer. We believe in the benefit of dua. And I think this could be an opportunity for some introspection and to really think about your purpose and really ask yourself some questions. And this could be a real opportunity for a spiritual renewal even.
Excellent. I thank you all for your time. I thank Dr. Zahir, Dr. Shiraz and Dr. Mateen for attending this particular panel on the coronavirus. And I ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that He protect all of you and your loved ones and your families, and that He keep us all safe. And I also ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that He keep the listeners safe as well. Thank you for listening. This has been another Kalam Cast podcast.